all of you have flown lots of other warbirds. How would you compare this to other warbirds you've flown, particularly the museum, and also for you, Eddie?
Well, I'll back up what Eddie said, that the feel of it is more like a straight-wing jet than it is almost any other piston airplane I've flown, only with tons of torque. It is very honest, it's powerful, it's fast, and the most remarkable feature I find is how well harmonized the controls are, the roll rate, the pitch rate, the forces, everything works just beautifully with each other.
Any of you, how well did it fulfill its mission requirements?
It did a really good job with mission requirements just by the length of time that it remained in service. Because, I mean, there are very few airplanes that stayed in service for, you know, this airplane was designed in 39. I first flew in 41. First combat mission was 44. And you figure it operated until 65. Yeah. I mean, that is a long time. I mean, they made some of them into drones, too. So they were remotely piloted, and they shot those down with meteors and stuff like that to try out missiles and different armament.
Was there any particular reason that the cockpits are so far separated?
I don't know. There's a fuel tank in between, nobody likes that.
Yeah. You got a little flying bomb there, I guess. Well, what do you guys get out of flying this around the country and showing it to the different people, personally?
You know, when I first finished the restoration, I mean, it was 8 years. I mean, it was a tough road to hoe. I mean, I had no idea. I mean, I think I'm kind of dyslexic, so when I look at a project, I kind of imagine what it looks like in the end and then kind of work backwards to figure out how I'm going to do it. You know, otherwise I would never do it. You know, you start at step one and go step 300,000 something. I mean, it's just overwhelming. And I think because I've flown fighters and all this stuff before, you know, the airplane was kind of underwhelming when I flew it the first time, and I was just relieved that it was just done. You know, I mean, I was just like so happy the project was finished. I can't take any more. It's just too hard. And people go, well, that's pretty anticlimactic. And I'd say maybe 7 or 8 years into flying it, all of a sudden I realized, you know, what I got to do. And it's just an absolute privilege because, I mean, if this thing could just talk, I mean, it's when you're alone with it in the hangar, cleaning it off or something at the end of, you know, flying it, it's basically 40 hours of my time for every flight hour. And that's not the mechanics, that's just me. I mean, that's to put it away, to clean it, to keep it, to make it look the way it does, to pre-flight it, to get ready to go on an air show someplace, takes probably 2 days. And somebody said, well, what don't you get? When these airplanes were in service, 100 people took care of 3 of them. And I keep waiting for the other 30-some guys to show up, but they haven't showed up yet. So, you know, it's just an overwhelming amount of work. I mean, just even to bring this here, it was 15 hours a day. Tim and I worked, you know, and it's just you think it's going to be easy. It just doesn't happen that way. But flying it, you know, the airplane really belongs to all of you guys. And I have to recognize all the Australians that are out here that have come from halfway around the world to see this. In fact, we have Air Marshal is out here, too, from the Royal Australian Air Force. And I know he's not a Navy guy, but we'll accept him. But you know, the airplane is really important to a lot of people. And I understand that, you know, I'm just, the more you fly it, they realize it's never going to be yours. You know what I mean? I paid a lot of money to be Jacques' custodian, like I said, and it's, you just get to take care of it and pay for it. And then hopefully it'll go on to somebody else.
How about you, Andy?
I can only echo what Captain Eddie has said, that it's such a privilege to be able to keep that history alive and to show it to new generations of people, to invoke that memory of the sacrifices made by those who went before us, who used them operationally instead of us doing it when the sun's shining and everyone's happy.
So you feel yourself lucky to be able to fly it?
Oh, it's an incredible privilege to be able to fly an aircraft like that, not only for the rarity, also for the joy of flying it, and also to participate in the museum activities with it.
How about you, Steve?
Well, my initial impression was that it looked like it would be something really cool to fly, but certainly I have a strong feeling for the historical aspect of it, but I remember taking it to a show near Ottawa, And finally, I met a veteran who had flown them, and it was a very emotional experience for him. So that's kind of sticks in my mind.
Yeah, I haven't had the opportunity to meet a lot of veterans. I met a Dutch guy that flew with these in Indonesia, and his description of this in combat was unbelievable. I mean, he said, oh, it was just magnificent when they came in for the strafing runs on the guys that were fighting in Indonesia. He said, you know, the Hawker Hunters would come in and drop bombs, and then the Firefly would come in and strafe on them. And he said, this, she is beautiful, he said, and this is absolutely magnificent. I'm going, oh, yeah, okay. And there was another guy we tried to bring him this year. Is one of the, he was a test pilot. He went on to become the tornado test pilot and the typhoon test pilot, and he was involved in a midair with these when he went to Australia. 21 years of age, they decided to go on an exchange with the Royal Australian Navy, and he and his best friend went down there, and his best friend did a head-on pass on a flight of three when they were up doing navigator training and hit his airplane. And he said there was a big thump when he went by. He said he looked out, and 7 feet of his wing was gone. And you know, you talk to these guys, and they're the ones that actually flew it. There's just very, very few people left that actually operated the airplane. And you guys all saw Bridges Over Toko Rii with Mickey Rooney in the helicopter and all that stuff. That was about a Firefly crew that was shot down in Korea and was rescued by the Navy crew that came and picked them up because they had a Sikorsky helicopter stationed on board HMS Sydney. And Hank, I got to meet the guy that was in the back seat, was still alive, and he escaped the North Koreans, and it was the U.S. helicopter that picked him up. And so the whole thing in the movie was about a Firefly that was shot down in Korea.
Okay, we've got, have you got anything else that you'd like to add right now? We're going to have question and answer.
Go ahead.
How about some Q&A? I got to get my mics out here.
You have a Merlin or a Griffin?
It's a Griffin. So this is the largest V-12 that Rolls-Royce ever built. It's 1,000 cubic inches bigger than the Merlin, 38 liters of swept volume, stock horsepower is 2450, and the way it's restored, if we had 150 octane fuel, which we don't have, probably 3,000. We've got 58 heads and banks on, so it's only an estimate. We don't haven't been able to run it at that.
Does it have a TBO or not?
I wish it had a TBO. But like halfway through life, you know, I think if you really take care of it, maybe 800 hours, maybe. The first engine we had in this, we pulled the heads and banks at 150. They were leaking coolant. I mean, it's been problematic, but I think the guys at Vintage V12s have worked on this. I mean, I don't know of anybody else in the world that can really overhaul one right now, but they've made all the molds for the seals and everything. And right now, you know, knock on wood, this new engine, I mean, there wasn't a leak all the way from Colorado, which is really amazing. It's because that has never happened with this airplane. So I think they've done 9 engines after this one was restored, and this was kind of the test engine. So now the new one's in here, and it's pretty fantastic. It's more durable than a Merlin because of the cam setups and all that kind of stuff.
When the British Pacific Fleet equipped itself, few of these, but mostly they used Corsairs and Hellcats and Avengers. How did this compare with the American-built aircraft, not only operated by the United States Navy, but also by the Royal Navy, in terms of performance and capability?
You know, like I told you before, they brought a Firefly back to Pax River, and I can't remember the name of the book, but it's a whole series of tests that they did with every aircraft. I talked to Eric Brown at length, who was, and I think you guys know who he was, you know, he's had more carrier landings than anybody ever, and he just died a couple of years ago. He was at 96 years of age, and he was really a great guy. And I asked him, I said, what do you think? And he compared it very favorably with, like, it was like Hellcat. And it shot down a lot of Oscars on the way, you know, they did all the Jimas, you know, Ichijima, Chichijima, all, you know, all on its way up to Japan.
So how many were operational in the Pacific at that time? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I have no idea. You know, you'd have to read the history, and they brought, I remember which squadrons went there, and they were on a number of carriers. And then, in Korea, then it turned into a ground attack airplane. That's why the invasion stripes are on it, because there were other propeller airplane there, but they were Yaks, and so they didn't want the jets to shoot them down. And so that's why you see the invasion stripes on the airplane. And they're from Korea.
Next.
Over here.
Okay.
Just a question. Why is there a shield on the port exhaust stacks?
Oh, there's a shield on both sides, and those are basically flash hiders for night flying. So, because the flames will just blind you, so you can't see them with the flash hiders on there.